Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
I'd like to welcome today to Crossover Peter Levinson, who is a long-respected jazz publicist. I'm speaking to you from your home in California. Is that right, Peter?
That's right. Here in Malibu, California, looking at the Santa Monica Mountains on a sunny day.
Well, I hate you right away.
Okay.
Actually, we have some beautiful weather here in Philadelphia. And I was fascinated by your book about Tommy Dorsey, Living in a Great Big Way. It was really quite a revelation. I always kind of thought of Tommy Dorsey as a kind of a calm, level-headed person.
With the silver glasses, one would think
But
he was anything but that.
As you well describe in your wonderful new book, tell us a little bit about how you got interested in writing about him. What was the thing that spurred you on?
Well, I had heard stories about him. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny because I well remember a date. I was with Harry James with the band up at Smith College in 1960. In fact, it was President's Day weekend, or then was George Washington Day weekend. And the James Band played a date up at Smith. And afterwards, I went with Harry and Dorsey's former manager, Tino Barzi, and Harry's manager, over to a wonderful place in New England called Wiggins Tavern. Great food. New England pot roast is their important dish.
Okay.
And we sat down, and Harry and Tino Barzi started talking about Tommy Dorsey with hilarious stories for over an hour. Of course, I don't remember any of them, and I wished I had remembered them. But I remember that stood in my mind of what an incredible character he was. And then I'd finished my Nelson Riddle book in 2001. I was fishing around for another idea. Who do I want to write about? And then I was leafing through the Encyclopedia of Jazz, the last one Leonard Feather and Ira Gittler did. And I noticed that Tommy Dorsey had been born in 1905. And I said, centennials. And Dorsey would be 100 years old in 2005. And then I knew by that time what an incredible character he was. And nobody had written about him since 1973. And I said, I think there's time, and I know where to find the people. And I went to it.
Now, this is part of a trilogy.
That's right. The first one was, of course, on Harry James. Nelson Riddle was the second, and Dorsey's the third. And, of course, they do have one character who kind of fits all through the three of them, and that is Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Sinatra, the silver cord that binds, I guess.
That's right. You could certainly say that.
Yeah. Now, again, musicians, I did some work with a show on Buddy Rich, and he also had a very volatile temper.
I knew Buddy Rich rather well.
And I think that that seems to be kind of a general, musicians are artistic. But I think that from what I can tell, of course, Tommy and Jimmy both were kids that were born into a very, very poor environment. Their father was a miner, I believe, mm-hmm. you said. They actually came from the area near Scranton, Pennsylvania.
That's right. It's Lansford and really Shenandoah.
Right. So it was really very, very poor.
Indeed.
And I would imagine that some of the things that Tommy Dorsey, his desire to social climb, to be in the company of, wealthy people and so on and so forth. I could see how that would happen to somebody who really had to start from the bottom and scratch his way up. But tell us a little bit about what happened actually with the names you list, read like a who's who of musical legends. And I'm talking about instrumentalists, really, essentially. He played and was in the company of some of the very, very great ones all the way through.
Yeah, I think that, you see, when the Dorseys, as teenagers, came on the scene, they started with Dorsey's Wild Canaries, which was a family band with the father playing cornet and Jimmy and Tommy playing trombone and clarinet. Of course, they had learned to play all the instruments of brass and reeds from their father. They segued from there and on, came back. They played as far south as Baltimore, and then they came back and they kind of disbanded. And the Scranton Sirens were a very important territory band. They were a member of that band. Jimmy got Tommy the job. Jimmy was the more advanced musician.
And, of course, he was older, right?
That's right. And most people think otherwise because of Tommy's authoritative way about himself. But then they played Atlantic City in New York. And so they had a little bit of a taste of the big time, not much, but there was, of course, jazz was forming because by that time in the 20s, it had come out of New Orleans and, of course, more importantly, in this case, Chicago. And then joining the Gene Colquette and Paul Whiteman band, there they were exposed to the greatness of Big Spider Beck and Bing Crosby, among others. And so jazz was really becoming the music of the 20s. The Roaring 20s was jazz, as you know. So then they came upon all these great young white jazz musicians who then came into New York and played with the California Ramblers, which had people like Red Nichols in it. Mm-hmm. And so then they became recording musicians.
But I have to ask you, you have a tidbit in there that absolutely stunned me. I couldn't believe it. When Eugene Ormandy came to this country, he was a pit. I mean, he was a conductor in the pit for, what was it, Earl Carroll's Vanities. And I think that didn't Tommy play in the pit with him?
That's right. More than once. In fact, he was involved with them and with several pit bands. And even arranged some music for the Dorsey Brothers Orchestra.
I know certainly from experience that many of the conductors do Broadway shows, and that's where they get, you know, they get a steady pay and so on. But that was really something, and it wasn't just a one-time thing.
They had an association for several years. And of course, I remember seeing Eugene Ormandy conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra Academy Music when I was a little boy.
Yeah, it's amazing how paths cross. And you have so much information in here that it's impossible for us to cover it. Our guest today is Peter Levinson, who has written a biography, Tommy Dorsey, Living in a Great Big Way. Some of Mr. Levinson's notes appear as a foreword in the Centennial Collection released on the Bluebird Legacy label, Tommy Dorsey, the Sentimental Gentleman of Swing. Excerpts on those discs begin with his work within certain bands in the 1920s, all the way up to his work with Elvis Presley in 1956. Again, when you research a book like this, of course, you have been a publicist for many, many years and are exposed to many musicians and the entire, you know, the whole scene. But where do you start? I mean, really?
Well, you have to rely on source books. And, you know, occasionally you make mistakes, knowingly, but certain source books are sometimes wrong, and then of course you repeat their errors. But for the most part, there had been a few books about Dorsey's recording career, which I counted on, and then of course there was the one other book that I mentioned that had been written by the radio producer of the Dorsey Brothers' various radio shows, so that there was plenty of background to get into. And then, of course, I did find, in the case of the Dorsey Brothers Orchestra, I was fortunate to find three people still living who were a member of that band. And, of course, were there with all the turmoil between the brothers in late 1934 and 35. And of course, one of them, Rock Hillman, described exactly what happened when that breakup took place on the bandstand at the Glen Allen Casino Memorial Day weekend, 1935.
That was a biggie.
Yeah. So that I had both source books and eyewitnesses. And throughout the book, of course, with Dorsey, there was no in-between. Musicians either admired him, respected him, or they loathed him. There was no, well, he was okay to work for. At times he was tough. It was nothing like that. The good musicians all respected him. The mediocre hated him.
Now, he was an alcoholic, wasn't he, practically?
Yes, at a very, kind of, if you were to play jazz in those days, you had to drink. That was just part of the life. And of course, marijuana was around in those days, and it wasn't illegal. But it was really booze became a very big problem for him and a lot of these guys.
The other thing that was. I mean, he had certain personality traits that were not particularly pleasant, from what
no.
I can tell.
Yeah, and I think that, as you mentioned earlier, the drive and the initial feeling that he had to make a great success and socialize with wealthy people, that was all a carryover from where he came. And, the discipline and the perfectionism, again, came from his father.
But who, incidentally, was a self-taught musician, wasn't he?
Yes, he learned to play all the reeds and brass instruments and then got his sons to do the same thing. I mean, Tommy was a fairly good trumpet player. His sound was actually kind of derived from Louis Armstrong, but he could certainly improvise quite well on trumpet. He was not much of a jazz trombonist. Mm-hmm. And, of course, his great frustration was that he could never be in the league of Jack Teagarden as a jazz trombonist.
Well, that's what I was just going to say, because he was very definitely a man that played pop and, I guess, swing to some degree, but he was not a great improviser, probably.
No.
Who did the arrangements for his orchestra?
Well, various people. The Dorsey Brothers Orchestra, the leading arranger, of course, was Glenn Miller, and it was only an 11-piece band, and yet it had a certain joie de vivre and a great brass sound that was made it sound like a 14 or 15 or 16-piece band. But then that was Glenn's ability to arrange for a bigger orchestra.
And also the fact that he reorchestrated for the Glenn Miller band, certainly the sound was different. I think he put the melody in the clarinet,
the clarinet
or something. Yeah,
was the lead instrument.
Yeah, that's the typical Miller sound.
Exactly.
But there was a lot of competition there, wasn't there?
And of course, with Tommy's band, he had people like, over the years, a lot of great arrangers, Dean Kincaid, Paul Weston, Hugo Winterhalter.
Oh, my, all the big
Nelson
ones.
Nelson Riddle,
yeah.
Of course.
And most importantly,
Cy Oliver and Bill Finnegan. Tommy knew the importance of an arranger, and he knew what an arranger could do to his band. And, of course, Cy Oliver's coming over in late 1939 completely changed the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra.
In what sense?
Well, it became much more of a jazz orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he had had hits on his own, starting out with The Music Goes Round and Round, and Song of India and Marie, of course, is two very big hits. And then in the late 30s, it was kind of a, let's call it a square Mickey Mouse dance band, and they did cover arrangements, cover was my versions of, in other words, the same arrangements of other bands of certain hit songs. And then it was kind of stuck in mediocrity, and Dorsey saw that America was suddenly jazz crazy, let's call it swing crazy, through the breakthroughs of Benny Goodman first and then Artie Shaw, and he saw that he was getting left behind, and he saw what Cy Oliver was doing with Jimmy Lunsford, and he asked him, how can I get you to come with my band? And Cy said, pay me $5,000 a year more than Lunsford did. And, of course, Dorsey could do that, and the rest is history.
And the history, too, I was shocked. I mean, the names that I grew up with that I remember. Remember Sinatra always talking about Axel Stordahl.
Axel Stordahl started the very first Tommy Dorsey band as a trumpet player.
Right. I didn't realize that. But if you have such a comprehensive book here. I mean, it's actually like an encyclopedia if you really want to.
I guess, thank you on that.
It's a nice read, too, and one finds oneself, say, oh my God, the Mosque Theater in Newark. Well, I'm originally from Newark, New Jersey,
really?
many years ago.
Well, that was an important theater.
That was a very, very important theater there.
As a matter of fact, in my publicity career, I remember a concert there that I was representing Johnny Mathis, who I represented later for several years at the Moss Theater in Newark.
Well, again, I remember the great classical musicians stopped there, too. That was there on their way to Carnegie Hall. They would do an out-of-town...
And that's exactly what the mosque was for Frank Sinatra going into the Paramount.
And of course, Sinatra, that name, again, everyone, stops dead in their tracks when they hear it. But he really felt very close to Tommy Dorsey.
Well, you see, I think the two key comments in the book are, A, Pop Dorsey saying, I'll do anything to keep my boys from going to the mines.
Yes.
Meaning, if I can instill a sense of the importance of being a qualified musician, then they will have a career and won't have to become coal miners and can leave this town. He succeeded, obviously.
Obviously.
The other one was Vince Falcone, who played piano for Sinatra in the 70s and then came back in the 80s later on. He said to me, Frank once said to me, the two most important people in his life have been his mother and Tommy Dorsey. That really says it all.
Well, he was his mentor, he said.
He was his mentor, and I think you're speaking from a musical point of view.
Yes.
But I think more importantly, he was his hero. I think every biographer of Frank Sinatra has missed a very, very salient point, and that is his whole personality was trying to be Tommy Dorsey.
Which is fascinating. I don't think anyone has ever
brought
that to
light. No, and I can't say that I knew Sinatra well, but I did know him for 30-some years, and I certainly saw the perfectionism, the drive, the temperament, all kinds of things that came just right out of Dorsey.
And also, you mentioned in passing that Sinatra's father was not particularly, I don't know if they were close or had too much influence over him. So Dorsey kind of took on this father figure.
Exactly. You know? Here he is on the road with his musical father and his father in other ways.
Yeah, right.
And so, those 3 years, speaking of January 1940 to the end of September 1942, those were the very important formative years in the life and the music of Frank Sinatra.
Well, Peter, I just have to say that you really got it all in this book.
And well, thank you. I put a lot of work into it.
A lot of work, and it's obvious, very, very obvious. Also, there are some wonderful CDs that are available as well.
Yes, the collection from Sony BMG, which is called Tommy Dorsey, The Sentimental Gentleman of Swing, the Centennial Collection, really covers the period of, the 20s when both Tommy and Jimmy were playing for various dance bands around New York, and then the Dorsey Brothers, and there's some tracks there with Bing Crosby and the Boswell Sisters.
Oh, my goodness.
And then it separates. Of course, Jimmy starts his own band, and then you have Tommy with all the hits in the second record in that package, and then the third is, of course, radio broadcast. And, for instance, there's a version of I'll Never Smile Again, in which is slightly, not in a major way, but slightly different from the usual, the famous recorded version.
Right.
And this is a live version.
So it's a very comprehensive
record.
Now, just quickly, you don't talk much about Jimmy.
Well, I in the book, I think I do.
To some degree, yeah.
Yeah, but you remember, Jimmy left, they would constantly have fights after their separation in 1935, and then Jimmy took over what was the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, and Tommy stole his band from Joe Hames, and that became his orchestra. So remember, Jimmy had his own career, but they would meet and have many reconciliations, followed by many fights and so forth and so on. So Jimmy is kind of interwoven, and then by the 50s, it was kind of a commandment from Mom Dorsey, who just said, Thomas, you must help the brother. Because they referred to each other. The brother was always that way.
Okay.
And Mac was Tommy's nickname, and Lad was Jimmy's nickname.
And of course, Jimmy was, of course, much more level-headed. Tommy died in 1956, right?
Yes, he died actually 2 weeks and 2 days after his 51st birthday. He suffocated, actually.
From
he had a dinner of two glasses of red wine, veal parmesan steak and uppers, because he was taking uppers off and on for the last 20 years because he knew that he just couldn't handle booze. He would be on and off, and then he started taking uppers, and that was his substitute, and of course it wound up killing him.
A terrible, very, very stressful life, though, for performers.
Oh, very definitely.
And especially,
I mean, as I titled the book, Living in a Great Big Way, is kind of a double entendre because, of course, that's what the band shouts out just before the famous Bunny Berrigan chorus on Marie, Living in a Great Big Way, Mama. And then it also describes the life of Tommy Dorsey, I think.
Yes, very, very much. And it's as I say, it's so comprehensive. Just one quick question. The Sentimental Gentleman of Swing, where did he get that name from?
Well, that was, I think, a publicist. In fact, the name of his publicist escapes me at the moment. I know he's mentioned prominently in the book. He was with him for many, many years. And that same gentleman also later became the editor of Downbeat. But I can't think of his name for the moment. But I think he gave it to him because, you see, Benny Goodman was the king of swing.
Yes.
Artie Shaw became the king of the clarinet.
Right,
they all had to have some kind of a moniker to sell them. And so they took Tommy's theme song, the very famous I'm Getting Sentimental Over You, and they adapted Sentimental as Gentleman of Swing.
And he wasn't really a gentleman.
Was I was about to see if you were going to say that.
Well, listen, Peter, we look forward. Can I mention the fact that you're working on another book?
Yes, you certainly can. I'm very immersed in a biography of Fred Astaire. It really focuses more on his artistry than the person, but it's called Panache, The Artistry of Fred Astaire, and it's going to be published in the fall of 2008 by St. Martin's Press. And I've spent about 2.5 years doing interviews for that and doing an awful lot of research.
Did you ever?
There's 31 movies and about 14 television shows.
I guess his valet is very important, too.
Oh, what's that?
Fred Astaire and his valet is very important. He was a wonderful little dresser, I think.
Oh, yes. That will be a separate chapter.
Exquisite. Well, Peter, a joy speaking with you, and the best of luck with this book. Thanks so much for finding time to come to us.
Well, I enjoyed talking to you, Jill.
Thanks, Peter. Bye.
Okay. Bye.